Bonjour, mesdames, messieurs, chers amis. C'est quand même une bonne chose qu'on peut reprendre les cours dans des conditions quasi normales. Bon, vous êtes encore avec des masques, mais déjà vous êtes en présentiel, c'est déjà une très bonne chose. Et en fait, cette série de conférences, on voulait la faire déjà l'année dernière. Et puis, pour des raisons que vous pouvez imaginer, on a dû le reporter. Et puis, cette fois-ci, Shirley a pu venir, même si actuellement c'est plutôt compliqué de rentrer en Israël, mais j'espère quand même qu'elle pourra le faire, ainsi que sa famille. Mais voilà, donc ce n'est pas le sujet aujourd'hui. Donc je voudrais très très brièvement vous présenter notre professeur invité, donc Shirley Bendor Evian, qui a fait ses études à l'université de Tel Aviv. Elle a fait son doctorat sous la direction d'Israël Finkelstein, que certains d'entre vous connaissent, et Deborah Sweeney, professeure en égyptologie, parce qu'elle est un peu entre les deux mondes, entre le Levant et l'égyptologie. Donc l'idée étant aussi que l'égyptologie doit un peu se dé, comment dire, décoincer d'une certaine manière, parce que souvent on a une vision un peu égypto-centrée de l'égyptologie, mais les Égyptiens, comme vous le savez, étaient partout, et surtout dans le Levant. Et c'est un peu, je dirais un peu le fil rouge de ces travaux, de montrer comment l'Égypte a interagi avec les autres aires géographiques et aussi les autres pouvoirs. Donc, c'est un peu l'idée de cette série qui s'appelle en effet l'Égypte et le Levant. Donc, vous avez, je pense, le programme. Sinon, je pense, c'est disponible à l'entrée. Actuellement, Shirley Bendor est conservatrice dans les antiquités pour les antiquités égyptiennes au Israel Museum à Jérusalem. Elle a monté très récemment une exposition qui peut vous intéresser. Du lien entre les hiéroglyphes et les émojis. Donc, vous voyez, les petits smileys et tout ça. Finalement, les hiéroglyphes sont en quelque sorte les précurseurs de ces émojis. Il a aussi publié un livre sur ce sujet, donc, que je vous invite à aller découvrir. D'ailleurs, sur le site, vous trouvez aussi, sur le site du Collège de France, vous trouvez les indications. Mais si vous, on n'a pas besoin, on n'a pas le droit de dire les machines de recherche, mais vous prenez une machine de recherche et vous tapez Shirley Bendor, vous voyez toute une série de petits films où on vous explique tout ça. Voilà. Aujourd'hui, le cours a lieu le vendredi, mais les trois autres cours qui vont suivre vont avoir lieu les mercredis, toujours aussi à 11h. On n'a pas pu faire mercredi à cause des conditions d'ouverture. Donc, en fait, c'est un des premiers cours de reprise. Voilà. Donc, Shirley va parler en anglais. Mais les PowerPoint, c'est un peu comme des versions sous-titrées. Donc elle va parler en anglais, puis mais vous avez les résumés en français pour ceux qui sont un peu inquiets par rapport à l'anglais. Mais elle prononce très bien, donc vous aurez pas trop de problèmes. C'est pas l'accent texan qui peut faire un peu compliqué. Voilà. Donc le thème, comme je vous le dis, c'est l'Égypte et le Levant. Donc aujourd'hui, ce sera sur les Philistins, les Cananéens, les Égyptiens à la fin de l'âge de bronze. Et ensuite, je vais vous présenter au fur et à mesure les autres thèmes. Je suis très heureux qu'on a pu réaliser finalement cette série de conférences. Si on a un peu le temps, à la fin, on peut poser quelques questions. Vous pouvez les poser en français et ensuite on peut traduire, donc il n'y a pas de problème. Voilà. Et voilà, aujourd'hui, on a tous besoin des portables pour des passes sanitaires. Ça, vous le savez. Mais les portables, mais se mettent aussi en silencieux. Donc, si vous avez oublié ça, voilà. Pensez-y avant la conférence. Voilà, Shirley, it's
Merci, Thomas. Alors, bonjour. This is my French for today. Thank you for coming here. I want to welcome professors, students, and the public that has just returned to the Collège de France. It's a very exciting time. And I should like to begin by expressing my deepest gratitude to Professor Thomas Romer and to the professors of the Assembly of the Collège de France for inviting me to give this lecture series on the relations between Egypt and the Levant. It is a great honor and a pleasure. So we shall dive right into this subject, and I hope that this first lecture today will be a little bit setting the scene and giving some background on this topic. And then in the previous lecture, in the next lectures, we will try to go a little bit deeper into specific issues of this Egypt and Levant interaction. But for me, standing here and talking about Egypt and Levant is very important and significant, because the importance of the relations between Egypt and the Levant and the rest of the world, in fact, was revealed immediately with the birth of modern Egyptology. Because, you know, for centuries, scholars and humanists and intellectuals tried to decipher the hieroglyphic writing and to reveal the secrets of the ancient Egyptian script. And the truth is that were it not for ancient Egypt's interaction with the Greek world, yes, the Rosetta Stone would have never been produced. And the hieroglyphic script of the ancient Egyptians would have remained undeciphered. So from the very moment that Egyptology was born, it was born due to its contacts with the outside world, outside of Egypt. And Jean-François Champollion, for whom the chair of Egyptology was created in the Collège de France and widely regarded as the founder of and the founding father of modern Egyptology, never considered Egypt without its regional context. And it was his vast knowledge as an Orientalist that enabled him to crack the code of ancient Egypt. And yet, despite this special importance of Egyptian and Hellenistic interactions, which resulted in a richness of written sources and proved to be so beneficial for the study of the histories of both cultures, the focus on interregionality soon turned to the relations between Egypt and the Levant. And this was perhaps a side effect of the growing importance placed by archaeologists on the field of biblical archaeology, which was beginning to catch center stage in world scholarship. It is not surprising then that the focus of early scholarship on the relations between Egypt and the Levant was the biblical account. And scholarship relied heavily on the newly deciphered Egyptian monuments. We need only to see the titles of these early publications, such as Les Hébreux et Moïse sur les monuments égyptiens, or Les circonstances de l'histoire d'Égypte qui en ont pu favoriser l'exode du peuple hébreu, yes, to understand the impact of Egyptology on biblical studies. And although this was very typical of early scholarship, and you can see these publications are really from the 19th century and the early 20th century, by the way, in the handouts, you have the bibliography that is on the screen according to its presentation on the screen, okay? So every topic has the relevant articles or books. So if we just look at these, you understand how important it was in early scholarship. But the truth is that this is also today a major focus of some Egyptologists and some research on Egypt and the Levant. I can just name maybe two. This is Hofmeyer, which in 1999 published a book called Israel and Egypt, the evidence for the authenticity of the Exodus tradition. And of course, Kenneth Kitchen, a very famous Egyptologist dealing with Ramesside inscriptions. And he wrote in 2006 on the reliability of the Old Testament. So again, this is still a very lively subject in Egyptology. But as biblical archaeology advanced towards a more cultural, anthropological, and less biblical perspective, so were the relations between Egypt and the Levant studied from the actual archaeological finds. And as time moved on, these were not restricted to Egyptian monuments, Because in the early 20th century, the results of numerous archaeological excavations in the Levant brought to light a wide variety of Egyptian imports and Egyptian-inspired local artifacts. So this was, you know, a revelation. And attested to the cultural interactions between the two regions. So the excavations of Beit She'an, for example, conducted in the 1920s by the University of Pennsylvania's museum, revealed Egyptian architecture, inscriptions, statues, stelae, amulets, and much more, providing a new way to understand the Egyptian records that mention place names in the Levant, and providing the first evidence for Egyptian imperial fortifications in Western Asia. The excavation of the Egyptian temple and garrison in Beit She'an was followed by the unearthing of an Egyptian governor's residence in Tel El Farah South. So Beit She'an is in the northern parts of modern Israel, and Tel El Farah South is in the southern parts next to the Egyptian border. And the large scale of Egyptian imperial interventions in Canaan began to be acknowledged. So we have this phenomenon, and then more Egyptian governors' residences were found throughout the land, from the north to the south. Major pharaonic finds, such as the huge basalt stelae of Seti I, or the larger-than-life-size basalt statue of Ramses III, and various architectural features were now clear evidence for the presence of Egyptians in Canaan during the New Kingdom area, a time roughly equivalent to the Late Bronze Age in Canaanite archaeology periodization. And we have a little discussion about the dates later on. These finds were now defining the archaeological layers of the southern Levant. Since the abundant appearance of Egyptian architecture and royal artifacts was unique to the Late Bronze Age strata, while earlier and later periods yielded humbler Egyptian assemblages. So this became a little bit like a marking point, a tell point. If you go and you excavate in a multi-period site in Israel and you come across all this Egyptian material, well, you think, okay, I'm in a Late Bronze Age stratum. Okay, and this again was a huge advancement in building the archaeological periodization of the Levant. As for humbler Egyptian assemblages that were not from the Late Bronze Age but earlier or later periods, these usually included scarabs and small amulets, which have turned up in very large numbers across the Eastern Mediterranean and have been studied as a material reflection of the relations between Egypt and the Levant, because they were not always imported, but sometimes were also locally produced by the Canaanite population, attesting to a degree of adoption of Egyptian practices, which were not influenced by Egyptian imperial conquests, but by other intercultural relations. So as we move in the 20th century scholarship, archaeologists begin to understand that Egyptian culture had a profound impact on the southern Levant. And this was not always related to a military campaign or to an imperial progress. These large excavations of the 20th century inspired a generation of interdisciplinary scholars to treat Egypto-Levantine interactions in broad and wide perspectives and provide historical archaeological overviews of the relations between the two regions. So this is not considered anymore a specific event of Egyptian-Levantine interaction. This begins to be a wider historical process. And so during the second half of the 20th century, we find massive compilations such as Helk's comprehensive publication, yes, this is the first one here from 1971, which is still widely cited and used by scholars today. And Redford's essential work on Egypt, Canaan and Israel, of course, the subject that is sometimes very hotly debated among scholarship. By 1990, a growing interest was fulfilled with the establishment of the journal, Egypt and the Levant, dedicated to this subject and making this a formal discipline by the same name. So today we have scholars who can say, this is my discipline, Egypt and the Levant. I am an Egyptologist, but I am also an archaeologist in the Levant, and this is a discipline of its own, the connection between it. To end this short, very short survey of scholarship, I would like to discuss some trends that can already be outlined in the studies of the 21st century. The first is the material-based approach, which focuses on a single class of items, such as the Middle Bronze Age scarabs, a study by Daphna Bento from 2007, or the Late Bronze Age Egyptian pottery by Mario Martin, discussing the dispersion patterns, contexts, and chronologies in order to reconstruct cultural processes. So you take a large database of scarabs, of pottery, you put them in the exact context where they were found in the archaeological sites, and then you find the parallels in Egypt and you start to recreate how these things moved from one place to another. To that, one might add the increasingly important application of methods from the exact and life sciences on archaeological material in order to obtain additional data that was invisible to the naked eye. To name just a few from a vastly growing body of works, we can name petrography, yes, the study of the composition of ceramics to identify its geological source, has been a pioneering element in these studies. So I'm only bringing here one article from a recent time, 2 years ago, regarding very early Egyptian interactions with the Levant, already in the first dynasty. And the other, which is widely used, is metallurgical analysis. Okay, the analysis of metallic components to identify copper provenance has also been significant in the reconstruction of Egypt-Levant relations. And again, I'm just citing one recent work out of many. We are looking at materials, and we are starting to understand that materials can also tell us about intercultural relations because we have to bring the materials from somewhere, usually far away. Another trend is a growing volume of works that venture to define Egypt's relations beyond the Levant and to include the Eastern Mediterranean, the Northern Levant, parts of Africa and Arabia, and most recently, even to discuss similarities in philosophical views between Egypt and China. These works already accept a rather new paradigm in the history of research that claims that globalization is not a term which should be restricted to the modern world. This has far-reaching implications on the kind of models of cultural interactions that can be used to reconstruct ancient interrelations, a point we shall return to during this series of lectures. Finally, one can point out modern studies that aim to explain the various material changes not in terms of simple exchanges of economic or military nature, but as the outcome of more complex and nuanced dynamics between cultures. The most obvious one is the imperial or colonial model, which is now more a bon ton to say, which has been used for the New Kingdom era, defining the material finds within the framework of elite emulation or colonial encounters and post-colonial theory. As this short review of scholarship indicates, other models of intercultural exchange are still not fully developed with regard to earlier and later non-imperial periods. So the imperial period in Egypt is the New Kingdom Age, and then it is very easy. We have a lot of theoretical frameworks to understand why things are treated in Canaan as Egyptian and in Egypt as Canaanite. But if we go to non-imperial eras, then we are left with less theoretical models to use. And I'm just going to show you a little bit the major hotspots of Egypt-Levant scholarship and the kind of intercultural exchange models that are frequently used to describe them. So the Old Kingdom, and we have very loose dates here. Yes, this is why it has a little thing. It's about, we're not going to go into exact dates here, but we are in the third millennium BCE, the second part of the third millennium BCE. The Old Kingdom, of course, is the time of the pyramids. It's already a full-grown pharaonic civilization. So interactions during the Old Kingdom era have centered on the Sinai Peninsula and the Lebanese coast and have been defined as commercial-based exchange, focusing on copper, turquoise, and wood. The Middle Kingdom, as we enter here the second millennium BCE, was mostly dealt with through the prism of the local production of scarabs in the Levant, related to the diffusion of Canaanite populations to the delta, a phenomenon known as the rule of the Hyksos dynasties. Other points of interaction at the Sinai mines have arguably brought upon the first experiments with the alphabetic writing. Although the cultural process that contributed to this exchange is still debated. During the New Kingdom, as I said, the imperial model can explain the appearance of Egyptian imports as well as locally produced Egyptian style and Egyptianizing artifacts. The persistence, however, of Egyptian traits after the fall of the Egyptian Empire in the Levant is not so well explained, and we'll talk about this later today. Indeed, following the collapse of the Late Bronze Age world order, okay, that's what we are going to start to talk about today, the occasional evidence for Egyptian influence on local tradition has been viewed as residual or trade-induced. It is precisely this post-imperial era, known in Egypt as the Third Intermediate Period, yes, the bottom paragraph here, Troisième Période Intermédiaire. It is precisely this period that interests me. This is because the society that evolves in this time in the southern Levant is ancient Israel in its most formative stage. And if we read the main text of ancient Israel, the Hebrew Bible, we find that Egypt was tremendously important in shaping its civilization. No other foreign place name is mentioned more than Egypt in the Hebrew Bible, more than 600 times, leaving Babylon 260 times and Ashur 145 times far behind. In this history of scholarship on Egypt and the Levant, the most commonly used models of intercultural exchange are imperial and commercial transactions. However, I was just talking about the Iron Age in Israel, the third intermediate period. Egypt was not conquering anything outside of Egypt at this time. This was after the fall of the Egyptian Empire. So why is it still so important? So we are still missing some kind of a model to explain the importance of Egypt in Iron Age Israel, since the imperial forces have long retreated and no significant evidence of commercial and economic ties are found in the Egyptian records. But before we rush into the Iron Age, we must first set the stage and observe Canaan through the Egyptian lens as it responds to the Egyptian Empire during the Late Bronze Age and how this response changes after the fall of the Egyptian Empire at the turn to the Iron Age. So around 1200 BCE, this is the Egyptian Empire in the southern Levant. It controls Canaan, which is something which is not completely equivalent to Israel. It's larger than that. It goes all the way, the Egyptian control goes all the way to the Lebanese coast, to parts of Syria, to Jordan of our days, and of course also in the south to Nubia, Sudan. And this situation lasted for centuries. And after centuries of Egyptian rule over Canaan, the resulting effect of Egyptian influence on all aspects of Canaanite life can be seen in iconography, in luxury items, in burial practices, in cultic rites, and even in the use of everyday kitchenware. Okay? So you have beautiful Egyptian vases coming probably from Egypt. There is now also, we found a local source of this calcite material, which is very Egyptian, but maybe also we have a local source in Israel. And we have beautiful luxury pottery, but we also have very simple pottery, okay, like the one there. So these are very simple bowls just for eating, okay, and they are in Egyptian style. So they were produced in Canaan at the time of the Egyptian rule. They're very frequent. We find them in many, many sites. And there is a big question, who is using this Egyptian style kitchenware? Okay, it's certainly not beautiful enough to be imported from Egypt to Canaan. We have nicer bowls in Canaanite repertoire. And it's certainly not enough beautiful to imitate on a local production. So we're thinking that actual Egyptians were in the area in all these beautiful garrisons, and they like to eat on their own kitchenware and not to do all this Canaanite preparation system. So we have from the most luxurious to the most simple, we have ivories that were definitely done in Canaan, but very Egyptianized in a real Egyptian style, and with various differences that come from Canaanite world and traditions. We have the very well-known anthropoid coffins made of pottery and found in several sites in ancient Canaan. And of course, we have jewelry and much more. All these are the things that you will find in late Bronze Age Canaan. Okay, it was a big exhibition at the Israel Museum called Pharaoh in Canaan, where if you see the catalog, which I'm sure you have, you will see all these and much more. So, but when the Egyptian Empire in the Levant came to its end around 1130 BCE, and this is the date chosen on the basis of this item, right? It is the latest royal Egyptian artifact in Canaan. It is a bronze base of a statue of Ramses VI found at Megiddo. So this is the latest. This is why we have this date, 1130. And the strata that come after this, no more Egyptian beauties are found. So if they are found, they're really sporadic. We don't have any more of these beautiful Egyptian assemblages. So the absence of Egyptian pottery in the following strata at Megiddo and parallel strata define the end of the Late Bronze Age. But we must remember that it didn't end in a day, in 1130. This was a process that started already earlier, in what is normally referred to as the collapse of the Late Bronze Age, also the subject of a very successful book by Eric Klein, okay, 1177, The Year Civilization Collapsed. And This process started earlier, probably with the appearance, or at least in historical records, of the famous sea peoples in the Levant. A very hot topic and the subject of numerous studies beyond this best-selling book. And the effect of this big change, the advent of the sea peoples and the end of the Egyptian Empire in the Levant, on local traditions was massive. Canaanite traditions that were local persisted, especially in the northern parts of Canaan, in the valleys, in the Jezreel Valley and so on. And new local settlements appeared in previously uninhabited regions of the country's highlands and deserts. At the same time, the appearance of new material culture in the southwestern part of the country was marked by an amalgamation of different influences from the Aegean, Cyprus, and Egypt. So when the Egyptian assemblages disappear from the strata in the Late Bronze Age Levant, in the southwestern part of Israel, we have a new phenomena of material culture, which shows all kinds of different influences, but they are all locally produced. This is important to note. These are not imports. They are all locally produced in southwest Canaan. Now, the Aegean elements of this pottery, and not just the pottery, there are also figurines, were usually explained by the mobility of the population from Aegean-influenced regions to the southern Levant. Okay, so this is the story of the sea peoples who are coming from the islands in the Levant, in the Aegean, to the Levant and bring their culture with them. But this is still a highly debated aspect of early Iron Age settlement. And it has a lot to do with the interaction between Egypt and the Levant and how we read this interaction. Along this predominantly Aegean and Canaanite nature of the material culture in southwest Canaan during the Iron Age, some Egyptian influences curiously manifest themselves. So, for example, beautifully decorated pottery was never the hallmark of Canaanite ceramics, unfortunately. Therefore, the appearance of decorated jugs and bowls in the archaeological record of the southern Levant attracted great attention. And many studies have been devoted to these assemblages of early Iron Age pottery, known also as Philistine pottery, Mycenaean 3C1B, which is a little derivative of Mycenaean in pottery, or simply Aegean-style pottery. The example before you is a type of jug that combines Egyptian, Canaanite, and Aegean practices and was produced and found only in southwest Canaan, mostly, but not restricted to, graves, burial grounds. The vessel is commonly white-slipped and decorated on the neck and shoulders. The neck decoration consists of a lotus flower or lotus petals. And of course, you know the lotus is a very important Egyptian motif, which is used in connection to the afterlife, to the ability to get a new life in the afterlife. The shoulder band includes a combination of motifs: checkerboards, birds, spirals, semicircles, fishnets, scales, and vertical lines. The lower part of the decoration is bordered by a few horizontal bands. The lotus decoration covers the long neck and dominates this composition. And some vessels portray even more elaborate ones than the one we see here, okay? But more like these that have also the buds and other parts of the lotus. Now, this is an example from Egypt, and this is an example from the site of Azor in southwest Canaan. And we can see how there is one aspect which relates to the other, this appearance of the lotus on the neck. Okay, and here we have another example from Egypt, which is even more explicit in the way this neck, which is a little bit bulging. Do you see this bulge here? It's the same bulge that we have here. So it's really the same shape of a neck of a vessel and the lotus decoration on it. In other examples from Philetia, the neck is covered by elongated triangles as schematic representations of lotus petals. So this has another development in Philetia itself. The Philistine jug differs in a few details from the Egyptian prototypes. Most importantly, the base was flattened. Okay, you see here this is a flat base. You can actually put the pottery on something, and here the base of the pottery is rounded, so you need a base to hold it standing up. And the decoration expanded to encircle the neck and shoulders rather than the front section alone. If you notice, in the Egyptian examples, okay, we have only this part which is decorated. The back is not decorated because this is an imitation of an Egyptian floral garland, okay? So it has strings in the back. It's like, right, a necklace. In the examples from Philistine pottery, we don't have that because obviously it's not Egyptian. It's some kind of adaptation of an Egyptian idea. The fact that the Philistine versions have forsaken the garland motif attests to their local production. In the process, Aegean elements were added to the composition in the form of birds and spirals. On the other hand, many of the Philistine jugs were found within burials, retaining the original Egyptian ideology behind the objects, because all of these Egyptian were found in burials. So, of course, this lotus flower has a strong importance for burials in ancient Egypt. Egyptian iconography and cult is also evident on the seals from southwest Canaan. The locally produced conoid stone seals are carved on older facets and display a local Canaanite interpretation of the name and images associated with the god Amun-Re, the leading deity in the Egyptian pantheon since the New Kingdom and on. Similar iconography was also found on scarabs and stamp seal amulets. These were made of steatite, an Egyptian stone that has been used for scarabs for centuries. After carving the shape of the amulet, usually a beetle, but not always, the stone was baked and glazed in green shades. These seals, normally referred to as post-Ramesside seals, were not restricted to southwest Canaan, and it is possible that some were not even produced in Egypt, but locally. Egyptian iconography also persisted on the very small assemblage of ivories that were found at the sites of Ekron and Kasile. Duck-shaped ivory boxes were popular in the Levant already during the Late Bronze Age, but resurfaced at Late Iron Age I Kasile. The ivory panels from Ekron display well-known Egyptian motifs in a local execution. The nude female swimmers are a common motif in Egyptian elotic scenes, as seen on this silver bowl with gold-plated scene from Tanis, the capital of the Lower Egyptian state around 1000 BC. A close examination of the bodily proportions of the swimmers, so you can see this one swimmer here and one swimmer here, okay? Also in the Ekron example, we see that this swimmer has the same kind of hairdo. Usually in Egyptian iconography, this kind of short hair tells you that this is either a servant, okay, or a lesser ranked woman. And the other figure is, yes, the lady, the mistress. So it has long hair, usually in a wig. And we see here the long hair, but you can see that this hair is already has some movement that the wig of the Egyptian example does not. So, and also the proportions of the body between the upper torso and the legs are different than the proportions in the Egyptian and canon. And the Egyptian artistic canon is something that you don't fall out from if you are creating this in Egypt. So obviously the creation of this ivory panel was not in Egypt. Other aspects of Egyptian culture in southwest Canaan after the fall of the empire can be seen in the cemetery at Tell el Fara South. You remember, this was a governor's residence, sometimes talked about as the most Egyptian building in Canaan. And around this site, there were a few graveyards, burial places. And in one of the cemeteries, Cemetery 500 it's called, there were five rock-cut chamber tombs that contained Philistine pottery of the kind that we just saw, like the jugs with the lotuses. And five of these were exceptional in their size and plan, as you can see here. And they were titled by Petri, who excavated the site, as the tombs of the lords of the Philistines. Now, these Philistine tombs yielded some Egyptian-type pottery and anthropoid clay coffins, okay, like the ones that we know from the Late Bronze Age. And were found anthropoid coffins in Bet She'an, in the Jezreel Valley, in the Late Bronze Age, yes? Lachish, Dir el Balach, all in the Late Bronze Age. The only place where it seemingly belongs to the Iron Age is here in Tell el Fara South. And in the Late Bronze Age, we consider these the coffins of either Egyptian imperial personnel who had the bad luck of dying outside of Egypt, and so they had to try and get some kind of Egyptian burial outside of Egypt, or it could also be interpreted as what is called elite emulation. So the local Canaanite population that wants to connect to the imperial rule, is influenced by the imperial rule, and actually takes on some of its practices. And this could explain perhaps the ones in Lachish. But in Iron Age site, after the fall of the empire, this becomes a little bit more hard to explain. So the reappearance of Egyptian-style burials in Tell el Fara South is also accompanied by a jar burial in Ashkelon, which has the figure of Anubis on it. Anubis is the jackal head god that protects Egyptian cemeteries. And we have one burial with Anubis in Ashkelon, also from the early Iron Age. So, if we sum up, and these are all the sites that we have here, from the perspective of Egyptian materials and influences, the transition from the Late Bronze Age imperial rule to the Iron Age was characterized by the near disappearance of Egyptian imports, inscriptions and architectural features, but surprisingly also with the appearance of Egyptian iconography and new practices in Southwest Canaan. The common interpretation of this archaeological data is what is called in scholarship the Philistine paradigm, built on the basis of the Hebrew Bible and Egyptian records. The first step equates Southwest Canaan with the Philistines based on the verse in Joshua 13:3. From the Shichon River on the east of Egypt to the territory of Ekron on the north, all of it counted as Canaanite, though held by the five Philistine rulers in Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gat, and Ekron. And the fine spots of these things here managed to tell us that this is maybe Philistia. Sorry. And of course, this is a shaky first step, okay, to take, since there is little evidence to support the contemporaneity of Joshua 13 with the early Iron Age. Most likely, this text was written centuries later. But let's continue with the paradigm. The second step relies on the contemporaneous records of Ramses III, who in his mortuary temple at Medinet Habu, on the western bank of the River Nile, has recorded his battles against those Philistines that we read about in the Bible. And he says there, the northern foreign countries quivered in their bodies, namely the Philistines and the Sikila. Their land was devastated. Their broken souls came. They were tehir, kind of warriors, on land, others at sea. And he continues, the foreign lands were betrayed in their islands, uprooted and scattered by land troops at one time, No land could stand before their arms. Chatti, Kod, Kalkemish, Arzava, and Alasya, all these wonderful empires of the late Bronze Age could not stand the advancement of these sea peoples. Devastated at one time, a camp was placed in a place within Amuru. Amuru, roughly present-day Syria, to the north of Canaan. According to these records, the Philistines, coming through land and sea, therefore receiving the well-known term sea peoples, coined by Maspero, Peuple de la Mer, coined by Maspero, camped in Amuru and threatened the borders of the Egyptian Empire. The third step is built on the papyrus Harris, written in the first years of Ramses IV, and containing a summary of the deeds of his father, Ramses III. I extended all the frontiers of Egypt. I felled the aggressors. They were in their lands. I slew the Danuna that came from their islands. The Sikila and the Philistines were made into ashes. Sheldon and Weshesh of the sea, they were made non-existent, captured at one time, brought as captives to Egypt like the sand of the shore. I settled them in strongholds, bound in my name. So when these resources were considered together with the appearance of new material culture in early Iron Age southwestern Canaan, a paradigm was born, initially stipulated by Alt and Albright. The scenario was that Ramses III defeated the sea peoples on the northern frontiers of the Egyptian Empire and proceeded to settle them in his strongholds in southern Canaan. The sea peoples subsequently forced the Egyptians out of Canaan and seized control of the region of Philistia. You will note that Papyrus Harris explicitly mentions that they were brought back to Egypt. Yes, let me go back a little. Okay. Brought back, amené captif en Égypte, comme le sable sur la plage. But the next phrase was understood by Alt and Albright to be related to fortresses, rather not in Egypt, but in southwest Canaan. Because there we have the Philistines, and there we have this new Aegean, maybe, pottery. Later interpretations of the inscriptions of Ramses III by Stadelmann and Bitak suggested that the sea peoples were defeated at the Nile Delta. This is the first maritime battle in history, in recorded history, and pulled back to settle southern Canaan either with or without Egyptian consent. This accommodated Papyrus Harris better, of course. There is ample Egyptian evidence for the settlement of captives in strongholds in Egypt itself, and captives from the Great Green. That's the Egyptian term for sea people, those who came from the Great Green, the Mediterranean. So we have records that telling us that captives from the Great Green were recorded as tribute in Upper Egypt, next to Nubia, falling in line with the Egyptian custom of placing war captives as far away as possible from their original home to prevent the possibility of escape or rebellion. In any case, both of these scenarios of the Philistine paradigm dated the initial Philistine settlement to the recorded date of Ramses III's campaign against the sea people in his eighth regnal year, 1175. And this is why Eric Klein's book is 1177, okay? The year civilization collapsed. It has a good ring to it, 1175, 1177. Now we know that we have also some more modified chronologies by Thomas Schneider, and it should be 1187, but this is really not that important. The paradigm assumes Egyptian involvement in the Philistine settlement process, either directly, yes, by stationing them, the defeated Philistines, in Egyptian Canaanite strongholds, or indirectly, by simply losing their sovereignty over Canaan in the aftermath of the conflict against the sea peoples. But there is a problem. As we just said, the excavations in southwest Canaan soon revealed that the appearance of Philistine pottery and culture was never accompanied by the assemblages of imperial Egypt. Okay, So they never come together in the same stratum. You always have the imperial Egyptian stratum with all those beautiful Egyptian luxury pieces and also simple pieces and so on. And on top of that, there is the Philistine stratum. So we don't have them living together at the same time. And this is a big problem because we have to revise this now. How can they be settled by Egyptians in their strongholds if they are not seen together in the archaeology? So this brought a slight revision of the paradigm. A territorial division existed between the Philistines on the southern coastal plain and the last Egyptian rulers of the northern valleys, the Shephelah, and the northwestern Negev. So if we have Philistines in Ashdod, for example, then they have their own little polity. And despite the fact that there is an Egyptian garrison, imperial garrison, in Tel Mo, 10 kilometers from Ashdod, they would never connect. Alternatively, the absence of any interaction between neighboring Egyptian and Philistine sites, such as Ashdod and Tel Mo, should negate their contemporaneity, dating the Philistine settlement to after the Egyptian withdrawal from Canaan. And this has started a very big debate in the archaeology of ancient Israel, the chronological debate, and it was expected that radiocarbon testing would somehow explain and give us a better understanding of the historical process, but this has not given us the resolutions that we want due to certain problems in the archaeology and the carbon dating of this particular period. So, but radiocarbon did at some point give an indication that this is probably the case, that the Philistine arrived after the end of Egyptian rule. So, we just saw a lot of Egyptian stuff in the Philistine material culture. And if they came after Egyptian rule, so what exactly is going on here in sense of the cultural exchange? Several models have been suggested in recent work. Post-colonial theory would rightly stress the lingering effect of empire on local populations. So the day that the British people left India was not the end of British customs that continued to influence India. Okay? But it seems that the population in Southwest Canaan were largely newcomers. So they were not bound by their colonial impressions. Trade relations no doubt persisted between Egypt and the Levant during the early Iron Age, cultivating a range of cultural exchanges. However, clear evidence for Egyptian trade in large Egyptian commercial amphora is restricted to coastal sites north of the Yalkon Basin and not evident in southwest Canaan. Of course, trade is not always traceable in the archaeological record, but it is strange that Nilotic fish bones and Egyptian amphora were found in the north of the country and not in its south, when it was the south that exhibits this fascination with Egyptian iconography and practice. Alternatively, a form of missionary can be read into the account of Wenamun, the trader priest of the 11th century BCE, traveling to Byblos to obtain cedars of Lebanon for the holy bark of Amun-Re. And his voyage is recorded in a papyrus that was found in Egypt, although it was probably all half literary and not really a statement, a document of a formal document. And it's true that this papyrus raises questions on the role of such trader priests in distributing religious ideas and practices, but evidence for this is restricted to Wenamun's tale. So a cultural model to explain this is not very easy to find and readily available. And What I would like to end with today in, you know, in preparation for the next three lectures is that perhaps we need to look at all this within a wider temporal perspective that manifests itself in this adoption and appropriation of Egyptian culture. From a longue durée perspective, the southern parts of Canaan were always Egyptianized to various degrees, even before the empire and certainly after it. For three millennia, ancient Egypt was a place of monumental architecture, advanced technological and material culture, and a unique socio-political organization. These were not just remarkable per se, they were also unsurpassed by their contemporaneous immediate neighbors in the southern Levant and in northern Africa. In that sense, Egypt, before the New Kingdom even, was already a cultural empire with far-reaching impact on the Levant. This was not necessarily linked to the actual exchanges of peoples or commodities, but to the mere presence of a dominant culture in the southern Levant that was idealized and imitated regardless of its physical presence in the Levant. For the next lectures in this series, I invite you to view Egypt through Canaanite and then Israelite eyes as the dominant culture of the southern Levant, and to explore this cultural supremacy through the modern model of a cultural empire, as elaborated at the turn of the millennium by authors Michael Hart and Antonio Negri in their redefinition of empire, one that does not have a territory, but is a form of sovereignty that relies on a globalized community and creates an impact that is not only an economic one, but also a cultural one. We will see that the basic conditions of globalization, media transfer, and stable domestic markets all existed in the ancient world of the second and first millennium BCE, and that these contributed to the formation of Egypt as the cultural empire of the southern Levant. Egypt was the beacon that southern Levantine nations looked at, admired, and were impacted by in a profound and lasting manner that endured for centuries. And we shall see that in the next few lectures. Thank you.